Hi, I'm Mark Brewer. For 18 years, I ran the Michigan Democratic Party. These days, I'm a lawyer and consultant to progressive nonprofits, political parties, candidates, and ballot question committees.
I'm Jeff Timmer. I battled with Mark and the Democrats for decades as executive director of the Michigan GOP and while advising Republican candidates at the local, state, and national level. Now I'm a political nomad who's put what's best for the country above carrying water for my former political party.
This is a republic if you can keep it. Inside the backrooms of Michigan politics with veteran political strategists Jeff Timmer and Mark Brewer.
Welcome back to Republic If You Can Keep It. In a few minutes, we'll take a deep dive into Michigan electoral politics with the leader of the progressive wing of Michigan's Democratic Party, 2018 gubernatorial candidate, Dr. Abdul El Sayed. First, Jeff, let's get up to date on an announcement you made last week about your promise to launch recalls against state legislators who vote to bypass Michigan voters and enact legislation which will restrict their freedom to vote.
Well, as we record here on late Wednesday afternoon, we know that earlier today, the Senate Elections Committee held more hearings on portions of the 39-bill package, following up on their hearings last week. They had discussion only. No bills were voted out. Chair Ruth Johnson kept repeating that half of Michigan's voters don't trust election integrity. Big surprise, since she and others spent 6 months telling them not to. So this is arsonists saying, hey, look, there's a fire we need to put out. We started it. Let's put it out. You know, that's their excuse to limit voting. And maybe if Republicans didn't keep repeating this big lie, they wouldn't feel this compulsion to satisfy their mob of angry voters who've, you know, they've armed them with the pitchforks, they've given them the torches, and gee, they're storming the castle. Big surprise.
Yeah, it really is a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? I mean, this goes back to, you know, the lies and misinformation we heard out of the Trump campaign. You know, we continued after the elections with all the frivolous lawsuits and the continued drumbeat that there were problems with the election despite audits and all of the studies indicating that everything was fine. But you're right, Jeff. Now they have created a situation where they've got to feed a beast that they created. And if they had a leadership bone in their bodies, they would stand up and say, all that was untrue and there's no need for this legislation. But instead, they're going the other direction.
Yeah, well, Ruth Johnson certainly has never met a leader that she wouldn't follow. She's not one. She has zero leadership qualities. She's willing to go along where anybody tells her to go. You'd think she'd know better on this, having served as Secretary of State for 8 years. But here we are. And so they seem intent on going down this path. And so, you know, Ruth Johnson seems like a great one to put in the recall crosshairs. The district she represents is one that has recalled legislators before. Paul Scott, the last successful legislator recall back in 2011, his House district was in Ruth's Senate district. So there's some history there. She was an anemic underperforming candidate in her election in 2018. Again, after having been Secretary of State for two terms, she limped into the state Senate with a very unimpressive vote total. If I was her, I would be real nervous about recall petitions showing up in my district.
Yeah, and that's a district that Democrats once represented in the prior redistricting. There was a Democratic state senator who hailed from Genesee County. Yes.
Yeah.
And down into the Oakland County portion of that district. And I know there's a lot of Democratic activists in both the Genesee and Oakland County portions of that district who I think would be eager to have a contest and give Ruth Johnson a real run for the money in a recall election. Shall we talk about some of the legislation that the committee talked about today? I mean, some of this stuff is just, you know, the worst of the worst. They talked today about the legislation that would close drop boxes at 5 o'clock the day before the election and leave them closed on election day. And as you and I both know from our election experience, that's the time of the election when those drop boxes are used most. And, you know, it's going to cause all kinds of confusion. It's going to force people to go to the clerk's offices, which are already going to be congested with people trying to register to vote and vote. So that hostility to drop boxes that legislation illustrates is a real disaster for election administration in Michigan, I think.
It is. And it's a clear, you have to look at the motive here. And the motive is to hinder people from voting early, because in the last election, just in the 2020 election only, Democrats voted at early and absentee at a greater frequency than Republican voters did. So since the Republicans seem to not be able to remember anything before, you know, Donald Trump, they don't recognize the fact that they have historically benefited from early voting in Michigan. They don't even recognize the fact that the increased turnout in 2020 is what saved them in down ballot races. Donald Trump lost because people who are inherently Republican voters, center right voters, were disgusted with Donald Trump, didn't want to vote for him, but they did want to continue voting for Republicans as they behaviorally had down ticket. And so, you know, the Republicans are cutting off their nose to spite their face. And, you know, I'm in no mood to help save them from their own stupidity.
Yeah, Jeff, I mean, 2 points. First, the history you recite of absentee voting in the state prior to last year is exactly that. When I was party chair, I always looked with great envy on the greater volume and percentage of Republican votes that came in by absentee ballot. You all had a great program, and your voters generally voted at absentee rates higher than Democrats. And so, again, Republicans have got complete amnesia about how popular absentee voting was and has been with their voters. Second point is, of course, while the bill as introduced was bad enough, they did make an amendment today. We'll see if it ultimately passes, which would say, well, you can close the drop boxes, or you have to close the drop boxes at 5 p.m. on election day. That, frankly, doesn't make it any better, because that 5 to 8 p.m. window then is going to be a nightmare for the local clerks, as those voters who discover and get angry about closed drop boxes then have to rush to the clerk's office, adding to the congestion there. And on top of that, the clerks, who can least afford to send staff into the field at that time on election day, are going to have to send staff out of their offices to lock the drop boxes. I mean, it makes no sense. And frankly, that improvement is not worth much.
If the polls close at 8 o'clock on election day, it seems that the drop boxes should close at 8 o'clock on election day. This isn't complicated. They're only making it complicated because their motives are impure. Let's call it what it is. And they're trying to prevent people from voting. They're trying to prevent people who vote in certain areas from voting. And this gets at the larger problem. You know, rather than some of the nuts and bolts of each one of these bills, their motive overall is to put their thumb on the scale in the next election to give themselves some benefit and latitude that they feel they lacked in the last one, to manipulate who voted prior to Election Day, who was able to participate, and then to manipulate the certification and counting process after the polls close. Rather than who wins the most votes, if something is simple and fundamental to our Democratic Republic, is who gets the most votes wins the election. If now we have to rely on which party controls the state capital in Lansing to determine the winner, we're headed in a illiberal, authoritarian direction, and I'm going to do whatever I can, and I know you are too, and I think our listeners and most people in Michigan, a sizable majority of voters, do not want to make these changes. And so the Republicans are heading in the wrong direction, and we're going to pursue recalls against those who are intent on walking this plank.
You make a good point, Jeff, about manipulation of the structure, the system of elections. It wasn't on today's agenda, but one of these bills will change the local boards of canvassers, and in big counties will enlarge them, adding another partisan or two. And in addition, for the first time ever, allow those boards to have a role in election administration. Specifically, they're going to have the authority to approve or disapprove these ballot drop boxes. And I bet you what's going to happen here is that county by county, Republicans on those boards are going to say no to drop boxes. So the legislature is going to be able to effectively ban these drop boxes, but do it at the local level with these Republican Trump activists that are going to get appointed to these canvassing boards. And then we're going to be in a world of hurt, because they are then going to use that position to manipulate the administration of the elections. This has problems written all over it.
There's a reason why the County Clerks Association, those who administer elections, predominantly, overwhelmingly made up of Republican clerks, oppose this. There's a reason that the largest employers and largest business groups in Michigan are saying, don't do any changes to election law without bipartisan support. If there are things that make sense, by all means, do them if you can agree across party lines to do it. But otherwise, don't do it. And so if we're not going to listen to those who deal with this as part of their job, whose job it is to administer the elections, who happen to be Republicans far more than they're Democrats, those county clerks, if we're not going to listen to them, if we're not going to listen to the major employers who say our customers don't want this, our employees don't want this, we think it's bad for business in Michigan, we think this is the bad a bad face for Michigan to show the rest of the country, don't do this. The Republicans in Lansing ought to listen to the majority of people in Michigan. They ought to listen to the clerks, and they ought to listen to the business leaders who are some of their biggest donors.
Yeah, it's been really encouraging, Jeff, in addition to your recall efforts, to see all of the opposition that you just outlined. I mean, I've been involved in elections in Michigan since the 70s. I've studied elections and election laws going back decades. This would be the biggest rollback of voting rights in Michigan history, easily, far and away. You know, there have been efforts to ban straight party voting. That's been contentious between the parties. That's a drop in the bucket compared to what's could happen here with the imposition of a photo ID requirement, these restrictions on absentee voting, and the election administration changes that are rolled into this package. It really is a counter-revolution to what we have progressively seen in this state under both Democrats and Republicans. You know, progressively, you know, facilitating the right to vote. And Michigan's got a great tradition, frankly, of nonpartisan election administration or bipartisan election administration. These canvassing boards have functioned very well. Democrats and Republicans keep an eye on each other, as you've indicated. And as I've seen, I have not seen Republican clerks in this state, either at the local or county level, doing anything other than their jobs, which is to count the votes honestly, regardless of their party, regardless of who's on the ballot. But these changes open the door to wreck that system, which has served Michigan well since the 1950s. And it would be a very, very bad thing for Michigan, as you point out, for our national image, for our business image, for people wanting to relocate here, either personally or for business reasons, to have this kind of chaos and uncertainty introduced into our election system.
And let's go back and put this in the context of all of these changes being pursued by Republicans in the legislature are to fix non-existent problems. There were not widespread, massive irregularities in the last election. We had the biggest turnout ever, by far, in 2020. And the number of irregularities, precincts out of balance, for instance, was smaller than in any previous presidential election. So increased turnout, decreased problems. There was no fraud. There's been zero evidence of fraud that's been brought forward by anybody not wearing a tinfoil hat, by anybody not named Pat Kolbeck, who comes out with his, you know, bat shittery that, you know, now has Dominion's, you know, threatening him with a $1 billion lawsuit like they have the MyPillow guy and Fox News. There are no massive problems that need fixing. We had tremendous participation. The Republicans lost the presidential election, but they won pretty much everything else. They held on to the legislature. They held on to county commissions. They didn't lose congressional seats this go around. And so this is a solution in search of a problem. I am all for, I spent the last 30 years doing battle with you and others under defined set of rules. We knew that people had access to participation. We had to make our case to the voters, and you win some elections and you lose some elections. And then you go on to the next election. You don't try to cast doubt on the previous election. We didn't spend 2003 with Dick Postumus out there saying, you know, Jennifer Granholm stole the election. I really won it. She's an illegitimate governor. People go on. Unless you're Donald Trump or the Republicans today, this has never happened before. It's happening now. It shouldn't be happening now. now, and we need to put an end to it, not cater to it, not change our laws because of this delusion, this insanity that's fueling the supposed public outcry that Ruth Johnson mentions here, with nearly half of Michigan saying they don't trust the election. It's only because people like Ruth Johnson have told them not to trust the election.
Right. You know, my experience on Election Day in the Democratic Party legal boiler room and at the TCF Center, I was at the TCF Center, you know, verifies everything you said. You know, I've been monitoring elections in the state, like I said, since the late 70s. And given the volume and the other challenges of this election, it was one of the smoothest I have ever seen. There were remarkably few problems for the legal boiler room to deal with on Election Day. And at the TCF Center, where I spent all day Wednesday, starting very early in the morning and then into the late evening and morning of the next day, I've never seen such a smooth Detroit absentee voting counting operation. It was very impressive. They got through, I think nearly 170, 180,000 ballots. Very promptly, everybody was thinking, oh, it's going to be Friday before we have the final count out of Wayne County, Detroit. They finished up late Wednesday night, early Thursday morning, which was remarkable given the volume that they had. And it was very smooth. But the only problems there were the people like Patrick Colbeck and others who are trying to create problems. This Melissa Carone, you know, a lot of her testimony was based on what she allegedly saw that day. She had no idea what she was looking at. And she was a mere, at best, a clerical employee that day of a vendor. You know, but from Colbeck being there, from her being there, we get all these wild accusations. And
Michon Maddock, another one.
That's
spreading these outright lies and deliberate misinformation.
All these, you know, there were a number of out-of-state groups that were there who lied their way onto the floor until they were caught and put in their place. So again, the only disruption that was going on that day, not inside the room as well as outside the room, pounding on windows, chanting and so forth, was caused by these Republican and allied group challengers. So it's just remarkable to me that they continue to try to perpetuate this myth, but unfortunately, many people in the Republican Party continue to buy it.
Jeff and Mark will be back after these messages.
Epic MRA is pleased to be a sponsor of this podcast. Epic MRA is a Lansing-based market research and public opinion polling firm with decades of experience measuring public opinion about politics, ballot proposals, federal, state, and local issues. Our clients include media outlets, school districts, colleges and universities, state agencies, and local governments across the state. When it comes to measuring voter opinions, Epic MRA has been known as the go-to Michigan pollster for over 25 years. Visit www.epicmra.com to learn more.
I may never have met you. We don't go way back. Maybe we wouldn't even be friends if we did. But when you wear a mask, you have my respect. Because your mask doesn't protect you. It protects me. I wear my mask to protect you. Mask up, America.
Brought to you by the Ad Council.
The Michigan Polycast. It's been called one of Michigan's top political podcasts by Hourly Detroit.
Each week, longtime political junkies Christine Barry and Walt Sorg offer news and views on Michigan politics and policy, as well as national issues impacting our pleasant peninsulas. And they are joined by some of the state's biggest names from government, politics, academia, and nonprofit groups, with an in-depth look at those issues.
Subscribe now to the Michigan Polycast, online at www.michiganpolycast.com.
Dr. Abdul El Sayed is a physician, epidemiologist, educator, author, speaker, and podcast host. He's a commentator on CNN, and his newsletter, The Incision, cuts into the trends shaping our moment. His books include Healing Politics, A Doctor's Journey into the Heart of Our Political Epidemic, and Medicare for All, A Citizen's Guide, which offers a no-nonsense guide through that important policy area. He's also the host of America Dissected, a podcast by Crooked Media, which goes beyond the headlines to explore what really matters for our health. He's a senior fellow at the FXB Center for Health and Human Rights at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health and a scholar in residence at Wayne State University as well as American University, where he teaches at the intersection between public health, public policy, and politics.
In 2018, Dr. El-Sayed ran for governor of Michigan on an unapologetically progressive platform, advocating for universal health care, clean water for all, debt-free and tuition-free higher education, a pathway to 100% renewable energy, and to rebuild the barrier between corporations and government. He went from being politically unknown to garnering 30% and coming in second in a three-way race. He was the youngest health official in a major U.S. city when he was appointed health director in the city of Detroit. He was charged with rebuilding the city's health department after it was privatized during municipal bankruptcy. As a professor at Columbia University's Department of Epidemiology, Abdul became an internationally recognized expert in health policy and health inequalities. Dr. El-Sayed holds a doctorate in public health from Oxford University, where he was a Rhodes Scholar, as well as a medical degree from Columbia University. He graduated Phi Beta Kappa with the highest distinction from the University of Michigan, where he was chosen to deliver the student commencement speech alongside President Bill Clinton. It's a pleasure to welcome Dr. Abdul El-Sayed to A Republic, If You Can Keep It.
Hey, how are you? Thank you for the invitation. To what do I owe the privilege?
I don't know how you do it. Reading the list made me tired.
Yeah, Mark was just saying, you know, we were talking about, you know, the intersection between public health, public policy, and politics, and you know, you're right there at the hub, and have a, I think, a very interesting perspective on everything that's going on right now from the science with the pandemic, the politics of everything COVID related, as well as just a general discussion of how things are affecting our politics and the intersection, the way politics and culture are so intertwined right now. And so, we've been having these conversations now for a couple months. I think this is our 8th or 9th episode. So one a week. And so we just wanted to reach out, and we're having some guests with creds on the left and creds on the right, and from a nonpartisan kind of media, some personalities, but we've had folks like John Kasich and Mike Dukakis.
All right.
Bill Kristol. And so we try to mix it up with some people with, very close to Michigan and those who, you know, are coming in from the outside. And so thanks for taking the time.
Yeah. Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. And I've got to say, Mark, the COVID flow here is, it's really, really impressive.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, they ask us how Democrats are going to win young voters. I'm just going to be like, show them a picture of Mark Rubio.
I wish it were that easy, Doctor. I wish it were that easy.
I think when we had Mike Dukakis on a couple of weeks ago, he recognized Mark from his days as an undergrad in Harvard back in the mid-70s.
There you go. There you go. It's back.
Well, there's so much here to talk about, Doctor. Let's talk about your views on where you think we're going to go now, frankly, with the pandemic. We have seen, it's just been remarkable to me. I'm no doctor. I'm a lawyer. It's just been remarkable to me how politicized the response to the pandemic has been. I remember, I took the Salk vaccine when I was a little kid, right? And we've been through, flu pandemics and so forth before, where everybody, without regard to partisanship, from what I remember, responded and did the right thing. But now it seems to depend on your politics as to whether you actually believe there's a pandemic, whether you're going to get a vaccine, et cetera, et cetera. So I'd be very interested in your views on how this is going to play out.
I have to say, it is really disheartening. You know, obviously, I wear two hats, one as a former public health official and one as a former candidate for office. And, 2018 is when I ran for office, and that was, approaching the height of our political polarization. And as the pandemic hit, in the first couple of beats, right, you could tell that this was going to be a real challenge to get through, particularly considering who was president at the time. And I worry a lot about it, because I think at core, right, the central question is, whether or not we can still achieve a bipartisan agreement that science is a legitimate means of ascertaining truth in the world. And the hard part is that a lot of the folks who have been pushing back on the idea that there's a pandemic, or that the idea that that vaccines are something that can prevent viral illnesses, particularly in pandemic proportions, the pushback stems from this almost assault on science and scientific integrity as a means of ascertaining truth. And I worry about the way that a particular brand of, conservative, I don't even want to say conservative, I say pseudo-conservative populism has rejected science wholly. And I think part of that, honestly, is in line with a full-on rejection of any system of truth-telling or truth ascertainment that is not, you know, what Dear Leader says. And, it is part of the playbook of autocracy that you tear down any other system of truth that is independent of you. And I think that's what Trumpism has done. And, it has left a lot of people, very sick and unnecessarily dead as a function of it. And the sad thing is, I actually think that we are going to get to a point where we have largely controlled this pandemic because of vaccines and what they enable out of the limited public health policy that we can do around like testing and tracing. We never got to do that at scale in this country, but I think we can do that at micro scale because most people are vaccinated. The worry that I have, though, is that because COVID denialism and anti-vaccine resistance run together, that you're going to keep having pockets of outbreaks in traditionally conservative communities. And as a scientist and a humanitarian, like that's a terrible thing. And none of us should be okay with that. But the hard part is that what do you do when you've given folks, I mean, you can lead the horse to water, but you can't force it to drink. So what do you do at that point? And I've had a hard time sort of wrapping my mind around that. I'll finish with one little point here, which is that I think there is a way forward. I worry, though, it's not going to come from people who look like me. It's just a function of, you know, what I look like, what my name is, how I pray, but also who look like me as a function of my education and academic credentials, because this is going to have to be a conversation that folks have inside of, you know, the sort of Republican tent. And Jeff, I'd love to hear your perspective on. I have a sense of what you think about how big or how far the Republican tent can stretch. But, you know, this is a conversation that folks like you and folks, to the, I don't know if it's the right of you or to the populist of you, are going to have amongst themselves, because at some point this hurts people, and it hurts people in profound ways, and it doesn't have to happen. And, you know, what is the cost of an ideology? I think we're going to find out. And that's a sad thing. I don't want to have to find out. I don't want anybody to have to find out.
Yeah, and well, we've seen what the cost is. The cost is, you know, 500,000 lives, or, you know, a good number of those who are unnecessarily lost their lives because of reluctance, because of stubbornness, because of politics, because of a political party and political leadership that was unwilling to confront the realities for whatever reason, and have perpetuated not just the deaths, but the economic destruction. You've got the kind of the paradoxical positions of people like Mike Shirkey here in Michigan, who are bemoaning the governor's, I think, very effective mitigation policies. They fought it every step of the way. And because they people like him and like that listen to him, people like him all over the state, we continue to have these outbreaks, and we continue to have needs to shut down businesses. The second wave that we saw last fall, where restaurants had to be shut down, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. They won't mask. They won't adhere to just simple, the social distancing that people in the Middle Ages figured out before they knew what the hell a virus was. They could have figured out how to stop the spread. And then you have last week, I think it was, that, you know, Shirkey saying the government should be encouraging people to get vaccines. I'm not going to get one myself, but the government should do a better job of it. It's that kind of psychotic, just kind of dual personality message coming from arguably the top Republican leader in the state that is going to continue to make it hard to get that the necessary level of vaccinations. You know, we've seen kind of the low hanging fruit. People who are willing to go out and get vaccinated are have done that, are continuing to do that. But now we're seeing the diminishing numbers every day of people getting vaccinated. It's getting that next, you know, 10, we're at 50% or so of the population who've gotten that first shot in their arm. But it's going to be getting that next 10 or 15 or, you know, to get up to 70% of the population, that's going to be galactically more difficult than it has been so far. And it's going to be almost impossible unless there is some level of sanity and encouragement coming from the political leadership on the right, because that's the only reason. Well, I shouldn't say the only. That's a large reason there's hesitancy. That's the only reason that there's real hesitancy in rural Michigan. It's going to continue to cause a problem. And Michigan's going to pay a price for it.
So, you know, what is – I'm curious, Doctor, if we can go down this path a little further. I mean, should we have some kind of rural health corps, you know, something maybe akin to what we saw during the New Deal – where to deal with these issues. And you're right. Somebody who looks like you or like me in terms of my background, my education, so forth.
And your hair, Sorry, that's like a non-starter.
Right. So, do we need to figure out a way that in these areas where this denialism, this anti-vax attitude is particularly strong, to, you know, develop some kind of, you know, local public health medical corps that goes into those areas, that people are from those areas that are trained and can talk to folks and be persuasive? Because I expect, you know, there are going to be more pandemics, right? There are going to be more public health issues. And you're the expert on public health in this conversation. And if we have people denying the facts, the science, as you're indicating, this is just going to be the tip of the iceberg. We're going to have worse and worse public health problems in these areas because of this denialism.
I mean, we have, and what you're speaking to, Mark, is the fact that our healthcare system has been supremely unkind to rural people. And, you know, I have a particular viewpoint on healthcare. I wrote a book called Medicare for All, but one of the reasons that I believe in it so deeply, and, you know, obviously it's become a politicized position. I came to this position when I was a medical student who never, ever thought he would ever, ever run for office, let alone, you know, be political. The point here is that the people who benefit most from Medicare for All, to be quite honest, are rural people. They're the people who benefit absolutely the most. And the reason why is because rural communities, as a function of automation, as a function of unregulated and unthoughtful free trade, they have lost earning opportunities. They are poorer and they are either uninsured or on Medicaid. The average Medicaid reimbursement is 27% of the average private health insurance reimbursement. So if you're thinking about a hospital in a for-profit healthcare system and you want to make money, you're not going to keep a hospital open in a rural community. You're just not. Not only is it that you are hit by the fact that most of your potential patients and customers in the system that we have are paying you 27% the price, it's also that they're far away and they can't get there. And so, you know, between those two things, we have an epidemic of rural hospital closure. And it's not just the hospitals, it's the primary care docs. It's all of the pieces of a healthcare system that underserves systematically low-income people in rural communities. And the second group that it hurts the most tend to be a group that I know a lot about from my past experience, which is low-income people in urban communities. And the problem here is that politically, right, these two groups, never the twain shall meet, right? And we allow our segregation physically to also be a segregation intellectually and socially. And that means that, you know, the people who would benefit most, right, are unwilling to make common cause with the other people who would benefit to actually get the thing done. Now, you know, we can talk about costs and we can talk about how you pay for it and we can talk about choice. But let's be clear, right? Low-income people in rural communities have no choice at all. There's no one there to take care of them. 47 hospitals closed in the middle of the pandemic. We're the only country in the world where 47 of our hospitals closed when people needed healthcare the most. And so, you know, I think the idea of a rural core is smart, but I take it a step further and just say, foundationally, if health insurance is your ticket into the healthcare system, then not giving people systematically access to health insurance means that nobody has a ticket, means that, you know, the carnival's not coming to town. And that's exactly what's happened in our rural communities all over the state and all over the country. And so it's a fundamental fix, right? We've got to rethink this idea of whose body matters to give healthcare, because implicitly in our healthcare system, if you're rural and poor, your body doesn't matter. If you're urban and poor, your body doesn't matter. If you're poor, your body doesn't matter. We believe that it's worth 27% the value to care for. And that's how it's written in our system. And so we could do better. And that means, I think, deciding that everybody's body matters the same. And that is the central premise under Medicare for All. So, you know, there's a lot that we can do around the icing, but we got to get the cake right in order to get the icing right.
You think there's a place, Doctor, for a leader who can unite those two groups that you talked about, that, like you said, never the twain shall meet. They don't agree politically. They don't agree culturally. They don't agree on a lot of issues, but they have these same basic healthcare and economic needs. Seems to me there's an opening there. Maybe it's a President Biden. Maybe it's somebody else who can truly, you know, deal with the needs of both of those groups and somehow bridge that divide. Do you think that's possible?
I hope it's possible. Here's my worry. You know, you sort of think about two people in a fight, and there gets to a point where folks are, even one side of them is so hot and bothered that reason doesn't matter anymore. And I just think what this strain of ideology, this Trumpism, has done is it has stoked that anger, resentment, racism, to divide folks in a way that makes it almost impossible to cut through. Right. And I really appreciate, there are a lot of things about President Biden's policies I wish could go further. But I really appreciate the fact that he has at all points tried to lower the temperature on our politics, because I think that's part of it. And the other part of it, though, is I actually think that we have to also deal with the elephant in the room. no pun intended. Sorry. Racism has been used as a tool in ways that that make it, you know, historically at least, an axis of foundational resentment and frustration among folks who believe that other people have taken theirs, whatever that is, whether it's their healthcare or it's their job or it's their stimulus check. And you know, the original identity politics in our country is you know, white identity politics, right? It was leveraged by Jefferson Davis way back against Abraham Lincoln in the Lincoln-Douglas debates. And I think that there was a great book written by Heather McGee called The Sum of Us, and she makes the argument that actually the fundamental challenge that we have to that kind of unity, to that kind of collective public good, is racism. And you know, she uses the drained public pool metaphor back in the 50s and 60s. So, you know, when Brown v. Board passed, they realized that this applied not just to schools, it applied to any segregated facility. And when Black citizens pressed their municipal boards for access to these lavish public pools in the South, instead of providing them access, they just shut them down. And it's a fantastic metaphor to understand healthcare, to understand all these public goods today. And I worry, right, that unless we are able to have a consensus conversation about race and about the way that racism has penetrated people's lives, that racism has been leveraged in ways direct and indirect to take resources away from Black folks and Brown folks, it's going to be really hard for us to come together. And I worry because this is not just a static issue. It's been accelerated in a particular direction by a particular group of politicians who have leveraged it for their own power. And they've made it this impenetrable. And I worry a lot about what that leaves us with. My hope is that Joe Biden, another leader, can bring folks together. I worry, though, that that coupled with the system of our conversation, you know, social media and misinformation, makes it almost impossible to do well. But, we can hope against hope.
Yeah. Well, I was going to add to that. I mean, what I see when I look at the Republican recipe for election success in 2022 and 2024 is going to be not just more of the same as we've seen over the last 4 years. It's going to be a heightening of the us versus them politics, because let's be realistic, their coalition is shrinking. It's a diminishing number of voters that the Republican Party is attracting. And so the only things that they can do is to whip the smaller base voters that they have, the smaller number of base voters, into a frenzy, motivate them to get out and vote. They're not offering an affirmative kind of policy position. There's nothing aspirational about the Republican message right now. And that's what frustrates me. That's been lost on the center right. It's just become this grievance, Festivus Eve politics where it just becomes somebody else is taking what belongs to you. And I think we're just going to see more of it because there's no other recipe given today's makeup, the leadership of the Republican Party. Nobody who would offer an alternative voice has any prayer of winning in the party right now. And so what we saw in 2020, what we saw in 2016 and 2018, we're going to see again next year in the midterm election, and we're going to see it in gaudy technicolor in 2024 with Trump or a Trump anointed candidate being the Republican nominee. And so we've talked about this on past episodes of this. We certainly dodged a bullet in the last election in the aftermath. But it's those who would lead us down the path of authoritarianism are just one election away from success. And that should scare everybody listening.
Yeah. In my lifetime, we've gone over, the arc from, Nixon's Southern strategy, right up through the Willie Horton ad. And every time we thought it can't get worse, it can't get worse. And then we get to Trump, ban Muslims, build a border wall, keep the Mexicans out. And that was just the tip of the iceberg. The open hatred, not even dog whistles anymore. The open hatred of other people who don't look or talk or act like you is really tearing our society apart. And I worry, as Dr. El-Sayed does, about whether we can come back together and find common ground and have the kind of dialogue we need to have where we agree to disagree on policies. But, we're all in this country together. None of us are going anywhere, despite what some may want or say. We've got to figure out a way to get along and to make this country work again.
I'd love to leave you with just two thoughts on this. I found that when I was campaigning, obviously I was campaigning in the Democratic primary, but there were a lot of folks who wanted to see the roadshow of like this, brown Egyptian dude. And we went all over the state. And I remember that, even when I'd talk to folks and some who came to like actively protest that I would even dare to run for office. When you actually talk to folks one-on-one, there is a challenge. It's deeply ingrained in humans that we, when we're looking in another human's eye, it's a lot harder for us to deny their humanity. And you're not dealing with the abstract concept, right, of a person. You're dealing with the living, breathing human being whose emotions are shown on their face. And I think if we have a future, it's going to be because we are able to get past these the systems of communication that make us think that we are talking a lot because we're saying a lot of words, and put us in granular communication that force us to see all the communication that's lost in our words when they're just words, they're decontextualized from a person. The second point I'll make is just, this is worth protecting. And, for me, I spent a lot of my summers in Egypt where there is no democracy. Nobody even pretends like there's a democracy. And I remember my grandmother, I was 13 years old and I was, starting to have a little bit of facial hair and looking a little bit older. And she pulled me aside and she said, look, you can't say anything about the president here. You do not have free speech. And the next time I went into the market with her, being the iconoclast that I've always been, I started to scream my cousin's favorite words that they taught me at the top of my lungs about the president. She pulled me aside and I thought I was fine. I thought, nothing had happened until that night. And there was a group of plainclothes cops that came to the house and asked, where's that boy who was saying things about our leader? And my grandfather sold vegetables at a fish market. He's never been afraid. I've literally never seen him afraid in my life. Toughest guy you'd ever meet. And I saw fear in his eyes the first time. He said, "Where's your passport?" And I went and I got my passport, and he held it up like it was an amulet against them. And he said, "He's an American. He has the right of free speech, and you can't say anything to him." And they said, "Okay, but tell him to shut up." And they left. And my American passport back in 1998 protected my freedom of speech 3,000 miles away. My dad came to this country, my mom came to this country believing in that. And that's what they wanted for their own country. And they never got it, right? There's still no democracy in Egypt. But we have that here. And I think folks need to remember that that's a special thing. The ability to say what you believe, to hold your views, to live with others who have their own views, that is worth protecting. And I think we have a responsibility to protect it. So I really appreciate y'all having me on. I know it's called a Republic if you can keep it. And my hope is that we can keep it.
Well, and with your help, we will. We really want to encourage folks to subscribe to your newsletter, The Incision, which I get regularly, and encourage folks to do that. But also to listen to your podcast, America Dissected. I think there'd be great value for all of our listeners in reading that newsletter and listening to your podcast, Dr. El-Sayed. Thank you so much for being with us. We just barely scratched the surface here today. Hopefully we can resume the conversation sometime in the future.
I look forward to that. I appreciate y'all having me on.
That's our time for this week, and a special thanks to Dr. Abdul El-Sayed for sharing his wisdom with us.
Feel free to comment, question, or criticize us. Send your thoughts to comments@arepublicpodcast.com or add your comments on our Facebook page.
And if you've gotten this far in the podcast, please share it on your social media. In just a few weeks, we've become one of the top 10% political podcasts in the nation. And we thank you for your support.
If the Republic is still standing, we'll be back in a week. Thanks for listening.
You can subscribe to A Republic If You Can Keep It wherever you get your podcasts or on our website, arepublicpodcast.com. A Republic If You Can Keep It with Mark Brewer and Jeff Timmer is a production of Michigan Citizens for a Better Tomorrow.